Today, we're going to continue our series, The Keenest Observers. The idea is to have conversations that include and connect about topics that are often framed by exclusion and divisiveness. Today's topic is immigration, and here's Rob Goodwin to set it up.
Thanks, Emily. Tomorrow, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump plans to unveil his immigration plan to the American public, offering what will possibly become U.S. policy should the Republican nominee win the 2016 presidential election. And whether you agree with comprehensive immigration reform or fall on the side of the deportation of what the United States Immigration Service cites as some 11 million undocumented immigrants that reside within the United States, Americans are grappling with the most contested issue of the 2016 presidential race, one that puts jobs and economics, the safeguarding of our borders from terrorist threat, and the rights of the undocumented immigrant up for political debate. But what happens when the political is personal and real lives are affected? My guests today have firsthand knowledge of the challenge of being undocumented in the United States. I'd like to welcome Carlo Aban, Ecuadorian-born, New York-based actor working at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Welcome.
Thank you, Robert. Good morning.
Good to have you. And a familiar voice to Jefferson Public Radio listeners, Jessica DeNova, who is the host of the Morning Edition. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. So it's fitting that The Keenest Observers begins its segment with a discussion of the undocumented and what it is to be somewhat unseen in America, but with a keen eye to what America kind of is doing in terms of that particular segment of folk. So when you were undocumented folk, because both of you all were undocumented folk at one time in your life, true? Mm-hmm.
Yes. For me personally, for nearly 24 years. Now, I was brought as a young child when I was going to be four. So that was, 24 years, because there wasn't a process, and there still isn't one if I hadn't married a U.S. citizen. But, there really it isn't as easy as filling out an application and standing in line. Mm-hmm. So that was my that's what blocked me from moving forward with the process of legalization.
And I was undocumented for 12 years, so about half the time. I was brought over as a child as well from Ecuador when I was seven. And we entered the country legally. We came on a tourist visa and then overstayed our visa and applied for a green card right away. But that process took 12 years for that application to be processed.
Yeah, that's an interesting insertion point to the conversation. I'm really interested to know what that view was as a person who seems like is more of a category than necessarily looked at as an individual in a country context.
Personally, it's definitely an interesting dynamic because all I knew was America, went to school here, K-12, and read the history and knew that in the United States, if you work hard for what you want, you get it and you earn it, but you have to work for it. So I knew my whole life about my status. I had an understanding of it. But for some reason, I truly believed that if I worked hard enough and, stayed low and followed the laws. I mean, I wouldn't even jaywalk sometimes mm-hmm. to that degree. But if I followed the rules and I did well in school, there was going to be a way. And every time, when it came time to try to get a driver's license or to go to college, I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to go to medical school because, I've come to realize I just thought that was the best, hardest thing to do that would get me in, but I actually couldn't apply when the time came. Have since discovered it's not necessarily my passion, and I discovered journalism. But anyway, yeah, it was definitely an experience where I was very much involved in everything, but at the same time felt like I was looking at these dynamics that, for example, I grew up in a very conservative county in Southern California, so I knew about the plight of undocumented immigrants, but at the same time, I saw the other side. It was very interesting. I feel like I've always kind of lived my life on the line between two sides and have been able to observe both sides. And really, a lot of the families that come here as undocumented immigrants have so much in common with families that are very conservative in the United States, some farming families, the morals and the values of hard work and earning what you want. they're very much in line, and that's something that I just said, man, if we could all just hang out and have a barbecue and speak, you know, I think we would all get along. Because another thing, and then I'll, you know, I don't want to take up the time, but having grown up light-skinned was a very interesting thing too, because I did see many of my friends constantly being recommended to take Woodshop or take home ec, and it's, you know, and people were always seemed to be surprised, at least in Southern California, that I was Mexican and that I spoke Spanish, which I've never hid, and I've always been very open about. I've always also very openly shared my story of, you know, being undocumented, more to show people that there are different, the face of an undocumented immigrant varies. But you know, there were definitely, I got to see, look from the outside on both sides.
Carla, Jessica's talking about the dual worlds, and I guess as we come up on our first break, I'd love to hear your view on if that was something you experienced, like a dual view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that adversity creates perspective, you know, and I think that people that are at the margins, that are marginalized, have a wider view of the world necessarily. You know, it's like you're just standing outside of the, you're not in the inner circle, but you're standing outside. So you kind of have, you know where you are, and you see where everybody else is as well. So yes, absolutely. Love to talk about that more.
Yeah, we'll come back after the break and talk about that perspective of the marginalized. If you're just joining us, I'm Robert Goodwin. Our guests are Carlo Alban and Jessica DeNova, and we're talking about immigration and the challenge of being undocumented in the United States. Stay with us. First, a short break. Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin. We're talking about immigration issues and the challenge of being undocumented in the United States. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Carlo, you were talking about an interesting perspective. You said folks from the margin, because they undergo adversity, that creates a broad perspective. Tell me more about that.
Well, you know, I grew up in New Jersey for the most part. We actually lived in California for 4 years in Buena Park because that's where my mother's family was, and that's who sponsored us for our green cards. But we moved to New Jersey when I was 11, and we settled in Sayreville, New Jersey, which was a pretty white town. There weren't a lot of Latinos there. And those were my formative years. I ended up going to Rutgers University. I didn't get my green card until I was 19. So my sophomore year of college, I got my green card. And my friends were all white. They saw me as one of them. And I feel like I had a sense, even at that young age, because I knew that we were undocumented, I had a sense of the entitlement that they had, the way that they viewed the world, their world was very small, and their very very limited perspective. And I don't judge them for that, and I didn't judge them for that, and I loved them, and I still love them, and they're still my friends. But I just coming from where I came from and having lived in another country and then living in this country in the political legal situation that my family lived in, I just had to be necessarily aware of a lot more things, and I had to deal with a lot more things, and I had to also, in dealing with that, keep quiet about it. Mm. And so that it was like growing up very quickly.
What are examples of those kinds of things that you all had to kind of be aware of? I hear you keep saying that I had to be aware of these things that were, you know, keep me safe? What are those things?
You can take it if you want.
Well, I mean, like Jessica said before, you know, I couldn't get a driver's license, for instance. And so that was a challenge. And it was something that we had to deal with in our daily lives. And I knew that there were other people like me, for sure. I knew that there were other people like me, but I didn't know where they were. We couldn't leave the country. We couldn't see our families in Ecuador. My grandfather, my father's father died, passed away, and he couldn't be there. We had to get fake papers in order to be able to work.
So there's hardships like that, and then just growing up fast is a really big thing, because you know, I don't know about you, but for me personally, I was the first one to pick up English, because, you know, you're submerged into it as a child, so legal documentation, you're kind of reading it, and you know it's really important, and, you know, you're translating for your parents, any letters that they're getting in the mail, or, you know, anything that's in English at that age. And then also, which, I grew up fast, but I wouldn't change it, you know, for the world. I think that the perspective that I have on life and the acceptance and tolerance that I have of people that are in a difficult situation definitely stems from growing up like this. But everyday challenges, something as simple as returning or exchanging clothes at a department store, you know, anything you could need an ID for, getting a card at Blockbuster, which we don't have anymore, but you know, the simple things in life, it's definitely interesting. And then when those milestones in life, like the driver's license, 21 and going out with your friends, you know, turning 21 and being denied because they don't accept your consulate card from the Mexican government. There are the challenges that are definitely legal and obvious, but it also kind of it takes a toll on you when you can't do the everyday, you know, and you grew up in America and you feel American, but you work through it, and here we are.
Indeed. And I think also, sorry, just to add just to add to the idea of perspective, being aware of the wider world and being aware of the politics. I think that that's something that, you know, if you were born here and you grew up here and you don't hear about these stories, it's just something that kids don't have to deal with in their daily lives. And being in a legal/political situation, and knowing the politics of other countries and knowing the politics of this country and having to be aware of that and learn it in case it comes up or anything happens, or just because your parents are dealing with it on a daily basis, that's perspective. Mm-hmm. That's perspective, and it shapes your worldview and it shapes you as a person.
We're talking to Carlo Alban and Jessica DeNova about issues of the undocumented. I think that that awareness of the politics at a young age and being aware of what those politics can really mean to your daily life is an interesting point, because most folk don't have to deal with that. We're, you know, as Americans, for better or worse, really raked over the coals for not being the most astute folk in terms of, you know, world politics, much less our own politics. But I mean, as this presidential election like continues to draw the line between very incendiary language on immigration, with, you know, fences and border patrol, and I'm sorry, what is it?
Border patrol.
But what's Trump is calling for a police force to come and get undocumented folk, all the way to just even, you know,
mass deportations.
Yeah, even comprehensive immigration policy and reform. What is that? I mean, when you hear these points of view, what is that? I mean, how does that, you know, resonate or not with you all, given your history and your present?
For me personally, the first thing that comes to mind is we talk about the need for a fence, you know, to protect ourselves or to protect the United States. I mean, again, I keep including ourselves in, because I feel I am American. But one thing that growing up, I always noticed housekeepers, people working in kitchens, well, some people's babysitters and some people's lawn people mowing lawns, I knew were of undocumented status. And I heard the homeowners speak about undocumented individuals and the criminals that, you know, the undocumented community, members of the undocumented community are, and the dangers that they bring into society. But it always boggled me. And as a child, I noticed it. You're giving us the keys to your home to clean and your children to babysit. I mean, do you really think we're that dangerous, or are we cheap labor? So that was something that always stood out to me. And the whole, you know, the idea of not paying taxes. The government issues undocumented immigrants a tax ID number to say, okay, you're here illegally, you're working, we want you to pay taxes. So put into the Social Security system. And I always did. I put into the Social Security system, so did my parents, but we weren't collecting Social Security. We weren't eligible for any, you know, federal or state programs, but we're definitely giving to it. So that's not true. You know, there's definitely, the government issues a legal number to pay taxes. I'm not saying everyone does it, but there are a lot of people out there that are paying taxes, but they're still not able to legally work in the country. So these are things that I was very aware of as a child.
Yeah, in terms of Trump's rhetoric, I mean, it terrifies me, not for myself, but for the people that are in that situation today. I think it's absolutely unrealistic. I think he has not really any kind of plan. I don't think he's going to build a wall. I think everything that he's saying is for political points and to try to get votes. But I think that in his rhetoric, he is bringing out a lot of hatred and a lot of misunderstanding. And I think that he's creating a really big social problem in this country. Or he's adding fuel to the fire.
Yes.
And on the Democratic side, when we talk about comprehensive immigration reform, there are elements of what could be, I guess, touted as a little bit more of the right side of the political spectrum as well as the left. What do you think about those notions of being able to have strong border control but also having paths to citizenship? Does that seem realistic as well, or no? Are we still talking about the same kind of unrealistic notions?
No, I think there absolutely can be a comprehensive immigration plan. I think that, yes, there will always be border control. There always has been border control. There always will be border control. We do not have open borders in this country. It's not that easy to get in. But people still do because they need to. You know, nobody comes to this country to live as a undocumented immigrant because they're, you know, trying to, you know, stick it to the man. They're coming here because, unfortunately, the economies of Latin America and Mexico and, you know, a lot of the rest of the world are not as great as the economy of this country. And this country exports its culture and its wealth, and that is very attractive. And so it attracts a lot of people naturally, and it is a country of opportunity, and there is room for everybody, and there is opportunity for everybody. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with patrolling borders, but to shut people down entirely and to not have a path to legalization and to citizenship is, in my opinion, absolutely immoral and unrealistic. People are going to continue to come to this country.
Definitely. For those who you know, say we are a nation of laws, just the same, we are a nation of immigrants. Those go hand in hand. And like Carlos said, what more do you need than a desert? I mean, people die, at least coming in from Mexico every day. There is a need for, you know, border control. There are definitely issues going on with firearms and drugs going in and out in both directions. So there definitely needs to be some sort of border control. Let people, you know, let's know who's coming in and out of this country. But the fact remains that the people that are bringing the drugs and weapons and crime into this nation, they're not the undocumented immigrants. And if there was a process for them to say, we are here and come out of the shadows and reduce the risk of exploitation, they're going to take it. I did as soon as I could. And I know my family and friends would do the same.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting, you know, point of discussion, especially when it seems to me the rhetoric of the issue starts really at its base becoming one of fear, like fear of lifestyle, fear of economics, fear of lawlessness, fear of difference. And it just seems to continue to be, you know, a common thread. And, you know, how do you break stereotypes in terms of the issue, much less get to an analysis on what it is in terms of economics, you know, of the people who are undocumented and what they how they really affect the economy or not.
I agree. I think, you know, I think back to something that Jessica said at the beginning of the show where, you know, you said that you grew up in a town where there were a lot of conservatives and you felt that there were a lot of parallels between your family and between those families. And if we could all just get together and
like
have a drink,
idea.
Have a
even
barbecue.
More so here, actually, in rural Southern Oregon, too,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and have a barbecue and talk about it. I mean, I think these kinds of conversations, you know, I think that people telling their stories and being open will lead to that kind of understanding. But
and
I think,
people being open to asking questions. Sure. If you don't know something, ask.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, but hateful rhetoric and talking about building walls, and that's going to have the exact opposite effect.
I would be remiss in not, you know, exploring the fact that I have a journalist and an actor, you know, in my midst. Those folk who are responsible for reporting or telling stories, how does that affect the prospect of clarifying this issue?
For me, it's been a bit of a challenge because I've always very openly shared my story, but I recently discovered, you know, my passion for journalism, and my family and friends, I'm sure, would definitely agree that they can't get me to stop talking and telling them stories. And they're like, okay, Jessica, enough. But it's you know, they say as a journalist, you should be neutral, you know, you shouldn't be biased, but we're all human beings, and this is my story. It's not me being biased. This is my reality. And I think it's always important to show as many angles that you can to a story. And I have covered immigration stories and issues here in the area, and I've gotten both sides. I think it's fair, but I also think that I have a moral responsibility when there are issues, when they're humane issues. You cannot ignore that. You have to take a stand when people's lives are on the line. And there are, I would say, more than 11 million lives on the line. We need comprehensive immigration reform, and we need to make sure that our nation is safe. We need to know who's here, and we need to make sure that we're not exploiting people. And I think the fear that we should have is a fear of people not wanting to immigrate to this country. Because when people no longer want to come to this nation, there's something wrong. We should be incredibly proud that people want to flock to the United States of America, because this is the land of opportunity. The American dream still exists. America never stopped being great. And I think that Carlo and I are excellent examples of how amazing of a nation this is.
I agree with everything Jessica just said. In terms of how does what I do affect my perspective, or, you know, affect my how I deal with this issue, I am so this is I guess I'll reveal this now. I was undocumented from the age of 7 to the age of 19, and I started acting when I was 11. I kind of fell into it when I was 11, and when I was 14, I was cast on a TV show called Sesame Street.
Oh, that little old show.
That little old show
called Sesame Street.
And so that created some perspective. And I was on that. I was on that show for 5 years, and the whole time that I was on it, I was undocumented, and they didn't know. Nobody knew. I, you know, worked on it with fake papers. I paid taxes. I had a social security number, and I paid taxes on all of the money that I made. And do to this day. And so because of that, that created in me the desire and the sense and the perspective that storytelling is very powerful. you know, storytelling is very powerful. And I was very scared at the time to tell this story, but once I felt like I had permission, and that was after I had my green card, and it took several years for me to process the things that I had gone through and my family had gone through, but I just felt like if I could just let people know, because I felt like what Jessica said, you know, you are these agricultural workers and these housekeepers, you're letting them into your home. There's an understanding, right? You're letting people into your home. These are not dangerous people. And in a similar way, I felt like growing up, I was in people's living rooms. They didn't know, but I was in people's living rooms. They let me into their home.
To entertain their children.
Right. Yeah, to entertain their children, and that feels very powerful to me.
I'm Robert Goodwin. Our guests are Carlo Alban and Jessica DeNova. And we're talking about the challenge of being undocumented in the United States. First, a short break. Back with the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin, hosting our guests Carlo Alban and Jessica DeNova. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Carlo, you were talking about a very, I think, vital story for the public in terms of how you were representing all that is, you know, America in terms of community.
Sure.
But, yeah. You know, had an interesting dichotomy.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Like I was saying before, I was on Sesame Street from the age of 14 to 19. And while I was on that program, I was undocumented. And nobody knew. And so that show is so quintessentially American, right? And so diverse, too. I mean, there's always been diversity in that show. There's been Latinos on that show since day one, since 1969. It's very much about a small community. There's all different colors, you know, including the purple and the aquamarine. You know,
the green.
Yeah. And green. Yeah. So I feel like people... That show feels like America to me, in a sense. You know, it feels like the American dream. It feels like everything that is good. Everyone that saw me on that show and my friends and everyone that knew me had this sense of me as this quintessentially American kid. And I was playing a quintessentially American kid, whatever that means. But at the same time, I was in hiding, you know, hiding in plain sight. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just created an incredible dichotomy.
Yeah, I could imagine that. I think that's an interesting, it continues to be an interesting conversation, especially with efforts like the DREAM Act on the table or DACA on the table, where the ability to have youth be integrated into the education and work system of America, as we're trying to figure out what the process should be, you know, allows folk to understand what it is to be American.
Yes.
But, you know, we're still trying to figure it out. And I think there are probably a lot of dichotomies then, you know. Well, so what does that mean to be a citizen? What does it mean to me, you know, a black man to be a citizen in juxtaposition to any other person, you know, in the same walk?
Yeah.
It's very interesting. But have you all worked on the DREAM Act or have been affiliated with the work around NAPA or NACA?
Yeah, for me to to be American for me was, you know, working hard and doing well in school. I think my escape was my education. And my mom, I remember her sitting down and opening up a dictionary for, you know, my kindergarten homework and looking up every word. My dad working on long division with me and me just being so frustrated because he did it the way they did in Mexico. And I was trying to do it the way they do it here. And I was like, I don't get it. But I fought through it. But I always shared my story when I had the opportunity, and it finally came time where I felt like I needed to do something because I needed to apply for college. And it was, I realized something needs to happen and I want to be a part of this movement. And I was lucky enough to discover the Orange County Dream Team, and we were a grassroots organization. They're still around. They have changed their name a little bit, but it's the same fight, you know, to dream and educate, advocate for the rights of undocumented students of all nationalities. And we started with little, you know, our own people marching in downtown Santa Ana, 5 or 11 people. We got the permits and everything to bring about awareness, having community events. And, you know, in a few years, there were hundreds of people on the streets. And to be part of that movement, I think, really shaped who I was. And to me, that became, again, America. You know, I read about the civil rights movement and you know, I read about, again, I believed work hard in school, you succeed academically, and that is your pathway. So to me, that was a big part of it. But DACA, unfortunately, is a Band-Aid. There's a bigger issue. And these students, like I said, I was able to legalize my status through marriage. Otherwise, I would be a DACA beneficiary. But it just gives you authorization to work, to get a driver's license. There needs to be a pathway to legalization because we are actually losing the opportunity to benefit from these students who are truly American and want to bring about amazing changes in their communities.
We have a call. Kevin in Mount Shasta has a question about assimilation. Kevin, you're on the air.
I'm on?
Yes, you are.
Hi, Kevin.
Welcome to the Exchange. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to, before I say the ask about assimilation, you know, I'm not sure what the immigration laws are right now, but if you are, you know, denied future entry into the United States because you got picked up on a illegal immigration situation, yeah, I think that's counterproductive. And just like any, I mean, if we're going to look at it within the context of the law, you know, broke the law, you pay whatever, you know, reasonable consequences that you're being given, and then you should be able to, you know, re-enter the process. So you don't think I'm a total redneck. But anyway, I'm an immigrant myself. I came here with my parents from Ireland. My dad had to wait a long time in line to be able to get here. But I do have a little bit of a older immigrant feeling of, I mean, I never felt like I fit in very well with most of the American culture, whatever that might be. But I still, I'm 65 years old now, and I do feel that the concept of assimilation is part of being responsible in a country. So not just, I mean, just to have a, they use words like a diversity, generally lead to balkanization, because people that have certain ethnically or culturally defined groups that they identify with, you know, they may experience diversity when they go to school or deal with the government. But when it comes to where they live, they generally tend to live amongst like minds, and I think that's part of human nature.
Thanks, Kevin. What do you think about that idea that assimilation is about being responsible? And I'm going to make an inference that it is to social and to society and societal rules and ethics.
Well, I want to make sure that I wanted to clarify to make sure what he meant by that. But assimilation is being responsible. So I do think it's important that when you come here, you're going to be a part of the nation, right? You're going to bring new customs and cultures with you. And there are customs and cultures that already exist here. And I mean, we always celebrated Independence Day, 4th of July, you know, there are rules here that, you know, like paying taxes and that sort of thing. There are responsibilities that come with living life in your new home. And I do agree that these are things that, you know, one should abide by. But again, there are certain things that you just can't do in everyday life without that proper documentation. And I'm not sure I understood the question too clearly. I don't know if you want to pick it up, Carlo, if you knew what he meant by...
No, I'm not sure that I understood the question too clearly either, but I agree with what Jessica's saying. I mean, we did assimilate in many ways. My family, we started celebrating things that we'd never celebrated, like Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is not celebrated in Ecuador, but we started celebrating it here. And the 4th of July, and you know, my family didn't settle in a place where there was mostly Latinos. We settled in a pretty white town because that's where my father found work, and that's where, and we made a life, and we were good neighbors, and we followed the rules. Every rule that we could follow, we followed. You know, we were good, upstanding citizens. And to speak to what he said earlier on, what he said about you know, you break the law, you should pay whatever reasonable fine or there is, and then move on. I agree. When my family, when we became documented, we had broken the law by overstaying our visa. And at the time, and I believe that this was something that was instated by President Clinton at the time, if you were in that situation and you had broken the law, you paid a fine. My family, each member of my family paid a fine. And then we were able to get our green cards. So, and that's a process that can work and that has worked. And mm-hmm. if it's reinstated, will continue to work.
I've asked around and have heard that, you know, some people are willing to pay the fines. If there's a way, I mean, there have been so many people that have been taken advantage of by notaries or notarios pretending to be attorneys. You know, I can figure out a way for you to legalize your status no matter what anyone else tells you. They take thousands of dollars. There was actually a huge case here out of the Rogue Valley not too long ago. But people want this so bad, they will find a way to pay this fine. There is something that in 2001, if you didn't apply for legal status by the end of, I believe it was April 2001, you got a 10-year penalty, a 10-year bar. And that actually came up when I went to legalize my status. They wanted me to leave for 10 years, and then my husband could petition for me to be pardoned. But he had to prove hardship. And I mean, this could go, I could go on and on about this and would love to answer people's questions. They can message me on Facebook. But I had a great attorney, Kevin Stout. He works here locally, a great attorney friend, John Almaguer. And at the time, Kevin worked for Hecton Norman. And they just advised me and did an amazing job. And we were able to find a way to get around that. But it's just, it's on such a case-by-case basis. And there really isn't a checklist. If you meet these requirements, you're in, and we need that. We need to have a change in the system because, A, what's happening right now is it gets down to interviews, you know, one-on-one, and the system is incredibly backlogged. And B, it's subjective, you know?
So once you hit the requirements, there's still a subjective evaluation that has to happen.
Yeah. I mean, you sit down, and the person that I was lucky, I had a great agent that I was interviewing with, but she told me, listen, in the end, it's not going to be my call. Like, who's going to make this call? This person hasn't met me. You know, I want to talk to them. So it's definitely an interesting process. And had I not fallen in love with someone who was a U.S. citizen, I would not be documented. I would qualify for DACA. And this wasn't, you know, a citizenship marriage either. We dated for 8 years and then went ahead when we were ready. But, you know, it's that was the only option for me. You need someone to petition you to be a spouse. And in certain situations, a spouse or a parent that is a U.S. citizen. And that's not there for many people.
And when we say DACA, we're talking about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Act. You can get a lot of information on the internet. It was an Obama administration act that was, I was going to say passed in June 2012, but it was kind of enacted by his presidential power.
Yeah, executive order.
Executive order. We're talking to Carlo Alban and Jessica DeNova about the experiences of the undocumented in the United States. You talked about your path to citizenship, Jessica, but Carlo, how did it ultimately happen for you?
We applied for a green card through my mother's sister, who was a citizen at the time when we arrived here in 1986. And because it was a sibling-to-sibling application, there's different priorities, and it was a very low priority. So because of that, it took 12 years for us to finally get our green cards. And then there's a five-year waiting period where once you get your green card, you wait 5 years, and then you can apply for citizenship. I think I waited 6 years to apply. I applied. They lost my first application. I had to reapply. And then finally, I became a citizen on January 9th of 2006. So I'm a U.S. citizen now, you know, and I took that oath. And that, if no one, for those people that don't know, if you've never read that oath or heard it, look it up. It's very, very strong language. And it's, you know, anybody who questions the loyalty of someone who has become a U.S. citizen and said those words with your hand over your heart, I would beg you to reconsider.
I think that probably kind of makes one be very patriotic. And maybe it's a process that a lot of us may need to do more. Maybe that kind of overture and that ability to stand up and see what it means would probably give a lot of perspective to a lot of different people.
Yeah, it really gives you a sense of citizenship and the responsibility of citizenship and being a citizen. And I don't mean in a legal sense. I mean in a real life sense of being a citizen of this country and being active and being...
You're included.
And being included, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm actually getting ready here September 15th to take my oath. So pretty excited about that. I am a legal resident right now. You know, you have to be legal for 3 years. For me, I had to be legal for 3 years to be eligible to apply. So I'm excited. And yeah, it's definitely a strongly worded oath.
We've been talking with Carlo Alban and Jessica DeNova about the experiences of the undocumented in the United States. Carlo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Jessica, thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Most definitely. Mine too.